reluctantly forced into piracy. Once it does, we propose to leave promptly in whatever transport might be headed in the general direction of Europe, provided only that said transport is not captained by Asa Hickman. We may have to travel overland to Boston in order to do this, but so be it. I suppose it would be interesting to see what Boston looks like these days. The Back Bay still being water and all, I mean. At least the Common will still be there, if sporting rather more cows than we were used to. The fort is under the command of one General Anthony Wayne, and I have the uncomfortable feeling that I have heard Roger mention this man using the nickname Mad Anthony. I'm hoping this designation either does or will refer to his conduct in battle rather than in administration. So far he seems rational, if harried. Being harried is rational, as he is expecting the more or less imminent arrival of the British Army. Meanwhile, his chief engineer, a Mr. Jeduthan Baldwin, you'd like him, I think, very energetic fellow, is building a great bridge to connect the fort with the hill they call Mount Independence. Your father is commanding a crew of labourers at work on this bridge. I can see him just now from my perch on one of the fort's demi-lune batteries. He stands out, rather, being not only twice the size of most of the men, but one of the few wearing a shirt. Most of them, in fact, work naked, or wearing only a clout because of the heat and wet. Given the mosquitoes, I think this is a mistake, but no one asked me. No one asked my opinion of the hygienic protocols involved in maintaining a proper sick bay and prisoner accommodations either. We brought several British prisoners with us, including the aforementioned Captain Stebbings, who should by all rights be dead, but somehow isn't. But I told them anyway. I am thus persona non grata with Lieutenant Stacto, who thinks he is a surgeon but isn't, and therefore am prevented from treating the men under his care, most of whom will be dead within a month. Fortunately, no one cares if I treat the women, children, or prisoners, and so I am usefully occupied, there being a lot of them. I have a distinct notion that Ticonderoga changed hands at some point, probably more than once, but have no idea who took it from whom or when. This last point rather weighs upon my mind. General Wayne has almost no regular troops. Jamie says the fort is seriously undermanned, and even I can see this. Half the barracks are vacant, and while the occasional militia company comes in from New Hampshire or Connecticut, these normally enroll for only 2 or 3 months, as we did. Even so, the men often don't stay there full term. There is a constant melting away, and General Wayne complains, publicly, that he is reduced to, and I quote, Negroes, Indians, and women. I told him that he could do worse. Jamie says also that the fort lacks half its guns, these having been abstracted by a fat bookseller named Henry Fox, who took them 2 years ago, and managed by some feat of persistence and engineering to get them all the way to Boston. Mr. Fox himself having to be conveyed in a cart along with them, he weighing in excess of 300 pounds. One of the officers here, who accompanied that expedition, described it to general hilarity, where they proved very useful indeed in getting rid of the British. What's somewhat more worrying than these points is the existence of a small hill directly across the water from us, and no great distance away. The Americans named it Mount Defiance when they took Ticonderoga away from the British in 75. You remember Ethan Allen? Surrender in the name of the Great Jehovah and the Continental Congress? I hear that poor Mr. Allen is presently in England being tried for treason, he having rather overreached himself by trying to take Montreal on the same terms. And that's rather apt, or would be, if the fort was capable of putting men and artillery on top of it. They aren't. And I think the fact that Mount Defiance commands the fort and is within cannon shot of it probably will not be lost on the British Army if and when they get here. On the good side, it is almost summer. The fish are jumping, and if there was any cotton, it would probably reach my waist. It rains frequently, and I've never seen so much vegetation in one place. The air is so rich with oxygen, I occasionally think I will pass out, and am obliged to nip into the barracks for a restorative whiff of dirty laundry and chamber pots, though the local usage is thundermug, and for very good reason. Your cousin Ian takes foraging parties out every few days. Jamie and a number of the other men are accomplished fishermen, and we eat extremely well in consequence. I won't go on at great length here, as I'm not sure when or where I'll be able to dispatch this letter via one or more of Jamie's several routes. We copy each letter if there's time, and send multiple copies, since even normal correspondence is chancy these days. With luck, it will go with us to Edinburgh. In the meantime, we send you all our love. Jamie dreams now and then of the children. I wish I did. Mama. Roger sat in silence for a moment, to be sure Bree had had time to finish reading the letter, though in fact she read much faster than he did. He thought she must be reading it twice. After a moment she sighed through her nose in a troubled fashion and straightened up. He put up a hand and rested it on her waist, and she covered it with her own. Not mechanically. She gripped his fingers tightly, but absently. She was looking across at the bookshelves. "Those are new, aren't they?" she asked quietly, lifting her chin toward the right-hand bay.
"Yeah. I sent to Boston for them. They came in a couple of days ago."
The spines were new and shiny. History texts dealing with the American Revolution. Encyclopedia of the American Revolution by Mark M. Boatner III. A Narrative of a Revolutionary Soldier by Joseph Plum Martin.
"Do you want to know?" he asked.
He nodded at the open box on the table before them, where a thick sheaf of letters still remained unopened, on top of the books. He hadn't yet brought himself to admit to Bree that he'd looked at the books.
"I mean, we know they probably made it out of Ticonderoga, all right. There are a lot more letters."
"We know one of them probably did," Bree said, eyeing the letters. "Unless Ian knows, I mean. He could have..." Roger pulled his hand back and reached with determination into the box. Bree drew in her breath, but he ignored it, taking a handful of letters from the box and flipping through them.
"Claire, Claire, Claire, Jamie, Claire, Jamie, Jamie, Claire, Jamie."
He stopped, blinking at a letter addressed in an unfamiliar hand.
"Maybe you're right about Ian. Do you know what his handwriting looks like?"
She shook her head. "I don't think I ever saw him write anything, though I suppose he can write," she added, dubious.
"Well..."
Roger put down the folded sheet and looked from the scatter of letters to the bookshelf and thence to her. She was slightly flushed.
"What do you want to do?"
She considered, her eyes flicking to and from the bookshelves and the wooden box. "The books," she said, decided, and strode across to the shelves. "Which one of these will tell us when Ticonderoga fell?" George III, Rex Britannia to Lord George Germain.
"Burgoyne may command the corps to be sent from Canada to Albany. As sickness and other contingencies must be expected, I should think not above 7,000 effectives can be spared over Lake Champlain, for it would be highly imprudent to run any risk in Canada. Indians must be employed."
Chapter 35. Ticonderoga. June 12th, 1777. Fort Ticonderoga. I found Jamie asleep, lying naked on the pallet in the tiny chamber that had been allotted to us. It was at the top of one of the stone-built barracks buildings, and thus hot as Hades by mid-afternoon. Still, we were rarely in it during the day, Jamie being out on the lake with the bridge builders, and I being in the hospital building, or the family quarters, all of those being equally hot, of course. By the same token, though, the stones held enough heat to keep us warm in the cool evenings. There was no fireplace, and it did have a small window. There was a good breeze off the water toward sunset, and for a few hours between, say, 10 p.m. and 2 a.m, it was very pleasant. It was about 8 now, still light out and still toasty in. Sweat shone on Jamie's shoulders and darkened the hair at his temples to a deep bronze. On the good side, our tiny attic was the only room at the top of the building, and thus had some modicum of privacy. On the other hand, there were 48 stone steps up to our eyrie, and water must be carried up and slops carried down them. I just hauled up a large bucket of water, and the half of it that hadn't spilled down the front of my dress weighed a ton. I put it down with a clunk that brought Jamie upright in an instant, blinking in the gloom. "Oh, sorry," I said. "I didn't mean to wake you."
"No matter, Sassenach," he said,
and yawned immensely. He sat up, stretched, then scrubbed his hands through his damp, loose hair.
"Have you had supper?"
"Yes, I ate with the women. Have you?" He normally ate with his crew of labourers when they stopped work, but sometimes was summoned to dine with General St. Clair or the other militia officers, and these quasi-formal occasions took place much later.
"Mm-hmm."
He lay back on the pallet and watched as I poured water into a tin washing bowl and dug out a tiny lump of lye soap. I stripped to my shift and began meticulously scrubbing, though the strong soap stung my already raw skin, and the fumes of it were enough to make my eyes water. I rinsed my hands and arms, tossed the water out the window, pausing briefly to shout, "Gardiloo!" before doing so, and started over.
"Why are you doing that?" Jamie asked curiously.
"Mrs. Wellman's little boy has what I'm almost sure is the mumps. Or ought that to be, are the mumps? I've never been sure whether it's plural or not. In any case, I'm taking no chances on transmitting it to you."
"Is it a terrible thing, mumps? I thought only Wayne's got it."
"Well, normally it is a child's disease," I said, wincing at the touch of the soap. "But when an adult gets it, particularly an adult male, it's a more serious matter. It tends to settle in the testicles. And unless you want to have balls the size of muskmelons..."
"Are you sure you have enough soap there, Sassenach? I could go and find more."
He grinned at me, then sat up again and reached for the limp strip of linen that served us as a towel.
"Here, Anian. Let me dry your hands."
"In a minute." I wriggled out of my stays, dropped my shift, and hung it on the hook by the door, then pulled my home shift over my head. It wasn't quite as sanitary as having surgical scrubs to wear to work, but the fort absolutely crawled with diseases, and I'd do whatever I could to avoid bringing them back to Jamie. He'd run into enough of them in the open. I splashed the last of the water over my face and arms, then sat down on the pallet beside Jamie, giving a small cry as my knee cracked painfully.
"God, your poor hands," he murmured, gently patting them with the towel, then swabbing my face. "And your nose is sunburnt too, the wee thing."
"What about yours?" Calloused as they normally were, his hands were still a mass of nicks, scraped knuckles, splinters, and blisters, but he dismissed that with a brief flick of one hand and lay back down again with a luxurious groan.
"Does your knee still hurt, Sassenach?" he asked, seeing me rub it.
It hadn't ever quite recovered from being strained during our adventures on the pit, and climbing stairs provoked it. "Oh, just part of the general decline," I said, trying to make a joke of it. I flexed my right arm gingerly, feeling a twinge in the elbow. "Things don't bend quite so easily as they used to, and other things hurt. Sometimes I think I'm falling apart." Jamie closed one eye and regarded me.
"I've felt like that since I was about 20, he observed. "You get used to it."
He stretched, making his spine give off a series of muffled pops, and held out a hand.
Come to bed, Anian. Nothing hurts when you love me.
He was right. Nothing did. I fell briefly asleep, but woke by instinct a couple of hours later to go and check the few patients who needed an eye kept on them. These included Captain Stebbings, who had, to my surprise, stoutly refused either to die or to be doctored by anyone but me. That hadn't gone over well with Lieutenant Stactoe or the other surgeons, but as Captain Stebbings' demand was backed up by the intimidating presence of Guinea Dick, pointed teeth, tattoos and all, I remained his personal surgeon. I found the captain mildly feverish and wheezing audibly, but asleep. Guinea Dick rose from his own pallet at the sound of my step, looking like a particularly fearsome manifestation of someone's nightmare. "Has he eaten?" I asked softly, laying my hand lightly on Stebbing's wrist. The captain's tubby form had shrunk considerably. Even in the gloom, I could easily see the ribs I'd once had to grope for.
"Him has little soup, ma'am,"
the African whispered, and moved a hand toward a bowl on the floor covered with a handkerchief to keep out the roaches.
"Like you say, I give him more when he wake to piss."
"Good." Stebbing's pulse was a little fast, but not alarming, and when I leaned over him and inhaled deeply, I detected no scent of gangrene. I'd been able to withdraw the tube from his chest 2 days before, and while there was a slight exudation of pus from the site, I thought it a local infection that would likely clear without assistance. It would have to. I had nothing to assist it. There was almost no light in the hospital barracks, only a rush dip near the door, and what little illumination came from the fires in the courtyard. I couldn't judge of Stebbing's colour, but I saw the flash of white as he half opened his eyes. He grunted when he saw me, and closed them again. "Good," I said again, and left him in the tender charge of Mr. Dick. The Guinea man had been offered the chance to enlist in the Continental Army, but had refused, choosing to become a prisoner of war with Captain Stebbings, the wounded Mr. Ormiston, and a few other seamen from the pit.
"I am English. Free man," he had said simply. "Prisoner, maybe, for a little, but free man. Seaman, but free man. American, maybe not free man."
Maybe not. I left the hospital barracks, called in at the Wellman's quarters to check on my case of mumps, uncomfortable but not dangerous, and then strolled slowly across the courtyard under a rising moon. The evening breeze had died down, but the night air had some coolness in it, and moved by impulse, I climbed to the demi-lune battery that looked across the narrow end of Lake Champlain to Mount Defiance. There were two guards, but both were fast asleep, reeking of liquor. It wasn't unusual. Morale at the fort wasn't high, and alcohol was easily available. I stood by the wall, a hand on one of the guns, its metal still faintly warm from the day's heat. Would we get away, I wondered, before it was hot from being fired? 32 days to go, and they couldn't go fast enough to suit me. Aside from the menace of the British, the fort festered and stank. It was like living in a cesspool, and I could only hope that Jamie, Ian, and I would leave it without having contracted some vile disease or having been assaulted by some drunken idiot. I heard a faint step behind me and turned to see Ian himself, tall and slender in the glow of the fires below.
"Can I speak to you, Auntie?"
"Of course," I said, wondering at this unaccustomed formality. I stood aside a little, and he came to stand beside me, looking down.
"Cousin Brianna would have a thing or two to say about that," he said, with a nod at the half-built bridge below.
"So has Uncle Jimmy."
"I know." Jamie had been saying it for the last 2 weeks to the fort's new commander, Arthur St. Clair, to the other militia colonels, to the engineers, to anyone who would listen, and not a few who wouldn't. The folly of expending vast amounts of labour and material in building a bridge that could be easily destroyed by artillery on Mount Defiance was clear to everyone except those in command. I sighed. It wasn't the first time I'd seen military blindness, and I was very much afraid it wouldn't be the last. Well, leaving that aside, what did you want to speak to me about, Ian? He took a deep breath and turned toward the moonlit vista over the lake.
Do you ken the Huron who came to the fort a wee while past?
I did. 2 weeks before, a party of Huron had visited the fort, and Ian had spent an evening smoking with them, listening to their stories. Some of these concerned the English General Burgoyne, whose hospitality they had previously enjoyed. Burgoyne was actively soliciting the Indians of the Iroquois League, he said, spending a great deal of time and money in wooing them.
He says his Indians are his secret weapon, one of the Huron had said, laughing. He will unleash them upon the Americans to burn like lightning and strike them all dead.
Knowing what I did of Indians in general, I thought Burgoyne might be a trifle over-optimistic. Still, I preferred not to think what might happen if he did succeed in persuading any number of Indians to fight for him. Ian was still staring at the distant hump of Mount Defiance, lost in thought. Be that as it may, I said, calling the meeting to order. Why are you telling me this, Ian? You should tell Jamie and St. Clair.
I did.
The cry of a loon came across the lake, surprisingly loud and eerie. They sounded like yodeling ghosts, particularly when more than one of them was at it. Yes? Well then, I said, slightly impatient. What did you want to talk to me about?
Babies,
he said abruptly, straightening up and turning to face me. What? I said, startled. He'd been quiet and moody ever since the Hurons' visit, and I assumed that something they'd told him had caused it. But I couldn't imagine what they might have said to him regarding babies.
How they're made,
he said doggedly, though his eyes slid away from mine. Had there been more light, I was sure I could have seen him blushing. Ian, I said, after a brief pause, I decline to believe that you don't know how babies are made. What do you really want to know? He sighed, but at last he looked at me. His lips compressed for a moment, then he blurted,
I want to know why I cannot make one.
I rubbed a knuckle across my lips, disconcerted. I knew, Bree had told me, that he had had a stillborn daughter with his Mohawk wife, Emily, and that she had then miscarried at least twice. Also, that it was this failure that had led to Ian's leaving the Mohawk at Snake Town and returning to us. Why do you think it might be you? I asked bluntly. Most men blame the woman when a child is stillborn or miscarried. So do most women, for that matter. I had blamed both myself and Jamie. He made a small Scottish noise in his throat, impatient.
The Mohawk don't. They see when a man lies with a woman, his spirit does battle with hers. If he overcomes her, then a child is planted. If not, it doesn't happen.
I said. Well, that's one way of putting it. And I wouldn't say they're wrong either. It can be something to do with either the man or the woman. Or it may be something about them together.
Aye.
I heard him swallow before he went on.
One of the women with the Huron was Cayenne Kehaka, a woman from Snake Town, and she kent me from when I was there. And she said to me that Emily has a child, a live child.
He had been moving restlessly from foot to foot as he talked, cracking his knuckles. Now he stilled. The moon was well up and shone on his face, making hollows of his eyes.
I've been thinking, Auntie, he said softly. I've been thinking for a very long time. About her, Emily. About Yexa. My wee bairn.
He stopped, big knuckles pressed hard into his thighs. But he gathered himself again and went on more steadily.
And just lately I've been thinking something else.
If... when, he corrected, with a glance over one shoulder as though expecting Jamie to pop up through a trap, glaring,
we go to Scotland. I dinna ken how things might be. But if I... if I was to wed again, maybe either there or here...
He looked up at me suddenly, his face old with sorrow, but heartbreakingly young with hope and doubt.
I couldna take a lass to wife if I kent that I should never give her live bairns.
He swallowed again, looking down.
Could you maybe look at my parts, auntie, to see if maybe there's aught amiss?
His hand went to his breech clout, and I stopped him with a hasty gesture. Perhaps that can wait a bit, Ian. Let me take a history first, then we'll see if I need to do an examination.
Are you sure?
He sounded surprised.
Uncle Jamie told me about the sperm you showed him. I thought maybe mine might not be quite right in some way.
Well, I'd need a microscope to see in any case. And while there are such things as abnormal sperm, usually when that's the case, conception doesn't take place at all. And as I understand it, that wasn't the difficulty. Tell me... I didn't want to ask, but there was no way round it.
Your daughter, did you see her?
The nuns had given me my stillborn daughter.
It's better if you see, they had said, gently insistent.
He shook his head.
Not to say so. I mean, I saw the wee bundle they'd made of her, wrapped in rabbit skin. They'd put it up high in the fork of a red cedar. I went there at night for some time just to... well, I did think of taking the bundle down, of unwrapping her, just to see her face. But it would have troubled Emily, so I didn't.
I'm sure you're right. But did... oh, Helly, and I am so sorry. But did your wife or any of the other women ever say there was anything visibly wrong with the child? Was she deformed in any way? He glanced at me, eyes wide with shock, and his lips moved soundlessly for a moment.
No,
he said at last, and there was both pain and relief in his voice.
No,
I asked.
Emily didn't want to talk about her. About Isabel. That's what I would have named her. Isabel, he explained. But I asked and wouldn't have stopped until she told me what the baby looked like. She was perfect,
he said softly, looking down at the bridge where a chain of lanterns glowed, reflected in the water.
Perfect.
So had Faith been. Perfect. I put a hand on his forearm, ropey with hard muscle.
That's good, I said quietly. Very good.
Tell me as much as you can, then, about what happened during the pregnancy. Did your wife have any bleeding between the time you knew she was pregnant and when she gave birth? Slowly, I led him through the hope and fear, the desolation of each loss, such symptoms as he could remember, and what he knew of Emily's family. Had there been stillbirths among her relations, miscarriages? The moon passed overhead and started down the sky. At last, I stretched and shook myself.
I can't be positive, I said, but I think it's at least possible that the trouble was what we call an RH problem. What?
He was leaning against one of the big guns and lifted his head at this. There was no point in trying to explain blood groups, antigens, and antibodies, and it wasn't actually all that different from the Mohawk explanation of the problem, I thought. If a woman's blood is RH negative, and her husband's blood is RH positive, I explained, then the child will be RH positive because that's dominant. Never mind what that means. But the child will be positive like the father. Sometimes the first pregnancy is all right, and you don't see a problem until the next time. Sometimes it happens with the first. Essentially, the mother's body produces a substance that kills the child. But... if an RH-negative woman should have a child by an RH-negative man, then the fetus is always RH-negative too, and there's no problem.
Since you say Emily has had a live birth, then it's possible that her new husband is Rh negative too. I knew absolutely nothing about the prevalence of Rhesus negative blood type in Native Americans, but the theory did fit the evidence. And if that's so, I finished, then you shouldn't have that problem with another woman. Most European women are Rh positive, though not all. He stared at me for so long that I wondered whether he had understood what I'd said. Call it fate, I said gently, or call it bad luck. But it wasn't your fault, or hers. Not mine, nor Jamie's. He nodded, slowly, and leaning forward, laid his head on my shoulder for a moment.
Thank you, Auntie, he whispered,
and, lifting his head, kissed my cheek. The next day, he was gone. Chapter 36 The Great Dismal, June the 21st, 1777. William marveled at the road. True, there were only a few miles of it, but the miracle of being able to ride straight into the Great Dismal, through a place where he vividly recalled having had to swim his horse on a previous visit, all the while dodging snapping turtles and venomous snakes, the convenience of it was astonishing. The horse seemed of similar mind, picking up its feet in a light-hearted way, outpacing the clouds of tiny yellow horseflies that tried to swarm them, the insects' eyes glinting like tiny rainbows when they drew close. "Enjoy it while you can," William advised the gelding with a brief scratch of the mane. "Muddy going up ahead." The road itself, while clear of the sweet gum saplings and straggling pines that crowded its edge, was muddy enough, in all truth. Nothing like the treacherous bogs and unexpected pools that lurked beyond the scrim of trees, though. He rose a little in the stirrups, peering ahead. How far? He wondered. Dismal Town stood on the shore of Lake Drummond, which lay in the middle of the swamp. He had never come so far into the Great Dismal as he was now, though, and had no notion of its actual size. The road didn't go so far as the lake, he knew that, but surely there was a trace to follow. Those inhabitants of Dismal Town must come and go on occasion. Washington, he repeated under his breath. Washington, Cartwright, Harrington, Carver. Those were the names he'd been given by Captain Richardson, of the Loyalist gentlemen from Dismal Town. He'd committed them to memory and punctiliously burned the sheet of paper containing them. Having done so, though, he was seized by irrational panic lest he forget the names, and had been repeating them to himself at intervals throughout the morning. It was well past noon now, and the wispy clouds of the morning had been knitting themselves up into a low sky the colour of dirty wool. He breathed in slowly, but the air didn't have that prickling scent of impending downpour. Yet. Besides the ripe reek of the swamp, rich with mud and rotting plants, he could smell his own skin, salty and rank. He'd washed his hands and head as he could, but hadn't changed nor washed his clothes in 2 weeks, and the rough hunting shirt and homespun breeches were beginning to itch considerably. Though perhaps it wasn't just dried sweat and dirt. He clawed viciously at a certain crawling sensation in his breeches. He'd swear he'd picked up a louse in the last tavern. The louse, if there was one, wisely desisted, and the itch died. Relieved, William breathed deep and noticed that the swamp's scents had grown more pungent, the sap of resinous trees rising in answer to the oncoming rain. The air had suddenly assumed a muffled quality that deadened sound. No birds sang now. It was as though he and the horse rode alone through a world wrapped in cotton wool. William didn't mind being alone. He'd grown up essentially alone, without brothers or sisters, and was content in his own company. Besides, solitude, he told himself, was good for thinking. Washington, Cartwright, Harrington, and Carver, he chanted softly. But beyond the names, there was little to think of with regard to his present errand, and he found his thoughts turn in a more familiar direction. What he thought of most frequently on the road was women, and he touched the pocket under the tail of his coat, reflective. The pocket would hold one small book. It had been a choice on this journey between the New Testament his grandmother had given him, or his treasured copy of Harris's list of Covent Garden ladies. No great contest. When William was 16, his father had caught him and a friend engrossed in the pages of his friend's father's copy of Mr. Harris's notorious guide to the splendours of London's women of pleasure. Lord John had raised an eyebrow and flipped slowly through the book, pausing now and then to raise the other eyebrow. He had then closed the book, taken a deep breath, administered a brief lecture on the necessary respect due to the female sex, then told the boys to fetch their hats. At a discreet and elegant house at the end of Bridges Street, they took tea with a beautifully gowned Scottish lady, a Mrs. McNab, who appeared to be on the friendliest of terms with his father. At the conclusion of the refreshment, Mrs. McNab had rung a small brass bell and... William shifted in his saddle, sighing. Her name had been Marjorie, and he had written a perfervid panegyric to her. Had been madly in love with her. He'd gone back, after a fevered week of reckoning his accounts, with a fixed intent of proposing marriage. Mrs. McNab had greeted him kindly, listened to his stumbling professions with the most sympathetic attention, then told him that Marjorie would, she was sure, be pleased with his good opinion, but was, alas, occupied just this minute. However, there was a sweet young lass named Peggy, just come from Devonshire, who seemed lonely and would doubtless be so pleased to have a bit of conversation while he was waiting to speak with Marjorie. The realization that Marjorie was just that minute doing with someone else what she'd done with him was such a staggering blow that he'd sat staring open-mouthed at Mrs. McNab, rousing only when Peggy came in, fresh-faced, blonde and smiling, and with the most remarkable... Ah! William slapped at the back of his neck, stung by a horsefly, and swore. The horse had slowed without his noticing, and now that he did notice... He swore again, louder. The road had disappeared. How the bloody hell did that happen? He'd spoken loudly, but his voice seemed small, muted by the staggered trees. The flies had followed him. One bit the horse, who snorted and shook his head violently. "Come on, then," William said more quietly. "Can't be far off, can it? We'll find it." He reined the horse's head around, riding slowly in what he hoped was a wide semicircle that might cut the road. The ground was damp here, rumpled with tussocks of long, tangled grass, but not boggy. The horse's feet left deep curves where they struck in the mud, and thick flecks of matted mud and grass flew up, sticking to the horse's hocks and sides, and William's boots. He'd been heading north-northwest. He glanced instinctively at the sky, but no help to be found there. The uniform soft grey was altering, here and there a heavy-bellied cloud bulging through the muffling layer, sullen and murmurous. A faint rumble of thunder reached him, and he swore again. His watch chimed softly, the sound strangely reassuring. He reined up for a moment, not wanting to risk dropping it in the mud, and fumbled it out of his watch pocket. 3 o'clock. Not so bad, he said to the horse, encouraged. Plenty of daylight left. Of course, this was a mere technicality, given the atmospheric conditions. It might as well have been the far side of twilight. He looked up at the gathering clouds, calculating. No doubt about it, it was going to rain. And soon. Well, it wouldn't be the first time he and the horse had gotten wet. He sighed, dismounted, and unrolled his canvas bedsack, part of his army equipment. He got up again, and with the canvas draped round his shoulders, his hat unlaced and pulled well down, resumed a dogged search for the road. The first drops came pattering down, and a remarkable smell rose from the swamp in response. Earthy, rich, green, and fecund somehow, as though the swamp stretched itself, opening its body in lazy pleasure to the sky, releasing its scent like the perfume that wafts from an expensive whore's tumbling hair. William reached by reflex for the book in his pocket, meaning to write down that poetic thought in the margins, but then shook his head, muttering, "Idiot," to himself. He wasn't really worried. He had, as he'd told Captain Richardson, been in and out of the Great Dismal many times. Granted, he'd not been here by himself. He and his father had come now and then with a hunting party or with some of his father's Indian friends. And some years before. But, shit, he said. He'd pressed the horse through what he'd hoped was the thicket edging the road, only to find more thicket, dark clumps of hairy barked juniper, aromatic as a glass of Holland gin in the rain. No room to turn. Muttering, he kneed the horse and pulled back, clicking his tongue. Uneasily, he saw that the imprints of the horse's hooves were filling slowly with water. Not from the rain. The ground was wet. Very wet. He heard the sucking noise as the horse's back hooves struck bog, and by reflex he leaned forward, urgently kneeing the horse in the ribs. Caught wrong-footed, the horse stumbled, caught himself, and then the horse's hind legs gave way suddenly, slipping in the mud, and he flung up his head, whinnying in surprise. William, taken equally unaware, bounced over his rolled bedsack and fell off, landing with a splash. He rose up like a scalded cat, panicked at the thought of being sucked down into one of the quaking bogs that lurked in the Great Dismal. He'd seen the skeleton of a deer caught in one once, nothing still visible save the antlered skull, half-sunk, and twisted to one side, its long yellow teeth showing in what he'd imagined to be a scream. He splashed hastily toward a tussock, sprang atop it, and crouched there like the Toad King, heart-hammering. His horse, was it trapped? Had the bog got it? The gelding was down, thrashing in the mud, whinnying in panic, muddy water flying in sheets from its struggles. Jesus! He clutched hands full of the rough grass, balanced precariously. Was it bog, or only a slough? Gritting his teeth, he stretched one long leg out, gingerly setting foot on the agitated surface. His boot pressed down, down. He pulled it hastily back, but it came readily with a poop of mud and water. Again? Yes, there was a bottom. All right, now the other. He stood up, arms waving stalk-like for balance, and... All right, he said, breathless. A slough. No more, thank God. He splashed toward the horse and snatched up the canvas bedsack, loosened in the fall. Flinging it over the horse's head, he wrapped it hastily round the animal's eyes. It was what you did for a horse too panicked to leave a burning barn. His father had shown him how, when the barn at Mount Josiah had been struck by lightning one year. Rather to his astonishment, it seemed to help. The horse was shaking its head to and fro, but had quit churning its legs. He seized the bridle and blew into the horse's nostrils, talking calming nonsense. The horse snorted, spraying him with droplets, but seemed to collect itself. He pulled its head up, and it rolled onto its chest with a great swash of muddy water, and in almost the same motion surged heavily to its feet. It shook itself from head to tail, the canvas flapping loose and mud showering everything within 10 feet of the animal. William was much too happy to care. He seized the end of the canvas and pulled it off, then took hold of the bridle. Right, he said, breathless. Let's get out of this. The horse wasn't paying attention. Its dish-faced head lifted suddenly, turned to the side. What? The huge nostrils flared red, and with an explosive grunt, the horse charged past him, jerking the reins from his hands and knocking him flat in the water. Again. You frigging bastard! What the devil? William stopped short, crouched in the mud. Something long, drab, and extremely fast passed less than 2 paces from him. Something big. His head jerked round, but it was already gone, silent in pursuit of the blundering horse, whose panicked flight he could hear receding in the distance, punctuated by the crashing of broken brush and the occasional clang of shed equipment.
He swallowed.
They hunted now and then together, he'd heard.
Catamounts.
In pairs. The back of his neck prickled, and he turned his head as far as he could manage, afraid to move more for fear of drawing the attention of anything that might be lurking in the dark tangle of gum trees and underbrush behind him. No sound, save the increasing patter of raindrops on the swamp. An egret burst white from the trees on the far side of the slough, nearly stopping his heart. He froze, breath held until he thought he'd suffocate in the effort to hear. But nothing happened. And at last he breathed and rose to his feet, the skirts of his coat plastered to his thighs, dripping. He was standing in a peat bog. There was spongy vegetation under his feet, but the water rose up over the tops of his boots. He wasn't sinking, but he couldn't pull the boots out with his feet still in them, and was obliged to draw his feet out one at a time, then wrench the boots free and squelch toward higher ground in his stockings, boots in his hands. The sanctuary of a rotted log reached, he sat down to empty the water out of his boots, grimly reckoning his situation as he put them on again. He was lost, in a swamp known to have devoured any number of people, both Indian and white. On foot, without food, fire, or any shelter beyond the flimsy protection offered by the canvas bed sack. This, the standard army issue, a literal sack made of canvas with a slit in it, meant to be stuffed with straw or dry grass. Both these substances conspicuously lacking in his present circumstances. All he possessed otherwise was the contents of his pockets, this consisting of a clasp knife, a lead pencil, a very soggy bit of bread and cheese, a filthy handkerchief, a few coins, his watch, and his book, also doubtless soaked. He reached to check, discovered that the watch had stopped, and the book was gone, and swore loudly. That seemed to help a bit, so he did it again. The rain was falling heavily now, not that it mattered in the slightest, given his state. The louse in his breeches, evidently waking to discover its habitat flooded, set off on a determined march to discover drier quarters. Muttering blasphemies, he stood up, draped the empty canvas over his head, and limped off in the direction in which his horse had departed, scratching. He never found the horse. Either the catamount had killed it somewhere out of sight, or it had escaped to wander alone through the swamp. He did find two items shed from its saddle, a small waxed packet containing tobacco, and a frying pan. Neither of these seemed immediately useful, but he was loath to part with any remnant of civilization. Soaked to the skin and shivering under the scanty shelter of his canvas, he crouched among the roots of a sweet gum tree, watching lightning split the night sky. Each blue-white flash was blinding, even through closed eyelids, each jolt of thunder shaking air gone sharp as a knife with the acrid smell of lightning and burnt things. He had grown almost accustomed to the cannonade when a tremendous blast knocked him flat and swept him skidding sideways through mud and rotted leaves. Choking and gasping, he sat up, swiping mud off his face. What the devil had happened? A sharp pain in his arm penetrated his confusion, and, looking down, he saw by the light of the lightning's flash that a splinter of wood, perhaps 6 inches long, was embedded in the flesh of his right forearm. Glaring wildly round, he saw that the swamp near him was suddenly studded with splinters and chunks of fresh wood, and the smell of sap and heartwood rose, piercing amid the hot, dancing scent of electricity. There! Another flash, and he saw it. 100 feet away, he had noted a huge, bald cypress, thinking to use it as a landmark come dawn. It was by far the tallest tree within sight. No longer. The lightning showed him empty air where the towering trunk had been. Another flash, the ragged spike of what was left. Quivering and half deafened by the thunder, he pulled the splinter out of his arm and pressed the fabric of his shirt to the wound to stop it bleeding. It wasn't deep, but the shock of the explosion made his hand shake. He pulled his canvas tight round his shoulders against the driving rain and curled up again among the sweet gum's roots. Some time in the night, the storm moved off, and with the cessation of the noise, he lapsed into an uneasy doze, from which he woke to find himself staring into the white nothingness of fog. A coldness beyond the bone chill of dawn went through him. His childhood had been spent in the Lake District of England, and he'd known from his earliest memories that the coming of fog on the fells was a danger. Sheep were often lost in the fog, falling to their deaths, parted from the flock and killed by dogs or foxes, freezing, or simply disappearing. Men were sometimes lost in the fog as well. The dead came down with the fog, Nanny Elspeth said. He could see her, a spare old woman, straight-backed and fearless, standing at the nursery window, looking out at the drifting white. She'd said it quietly, as though to herself. He didn't think she'd realized he was there. When she did, she drew the curtain with a brisk snap and came to make his tea, saying nothing more. He could do with a cup of hot tea, he thought, preferably with a great deal of whiskey in it. Hot tea, hot buttered toast, jam sandwiches, and cake. The thought of nursery teas recalled his wadge of soggy bread and cheese, and he drew this carefully out of his pocket, immeasurably heartened by its presence. He ate it slowly, savouring the tasteless mass as though it were a branded peach, and felt very much better, despite the clammy touch of the fog on his face, the dripping of water from the ends of his hair, and the fact that he was still wet to the skin. His muscles ached from shivering all night. He had had the presence of mind to set the frying pan out in the rain the night before, and thus had fresh water to drink, tasting deliciously of bacon fat. "Not so bad," he said aloud, wiping his mouth. "Yet." His voice sounded strange. Voices always did, in a fog. He'd been lost in fog twice before, and he had no desire to repeat that experiment, though repeat it he did, now and then, in nightmares, stumbling blind through a white so thick he couldn't see his own feet, hearing the voices of the dead. He closed his eyes, preferring momentary darkness to the swirl of white, but could still feel its fingers, cold on his face. He'd heard the voices then. He tried not to listen now. He got to his feet, determined. He had to move. At the same time, to go wandering blind through bogs and clinging growth would be madness. He tied the frying pan to his belt, and slinging the wet canvas over his shoulder, put out a hand and began to grope. Juniper wouldn't do. The wood shredded under a knife, and the trees grew in such fashion that no branch ran straight for more than a few inches. Sweet gum or tupelo was better, but an alder would be best. He found a small stand of alder saplings after an age of sidling cautiously through the mist, planting one foot at a time, and waiting to see the effect, pausing whenever he hit a tree to press its leaves to his mouth and nose by way of identification. Feeling about among the slender trunks, he picked one an inch or so in diameter, and, planting his feet solidly, grasped the sapling with both hands and wrenched it up. It came, with a groan of yielding earth and a shower of leaves, and a heavy body slithered suddenly across his boot. He let out a cry and smashed the root end of his sapling down, but the snake had long since fled. Sweating despite the chill, he undid the frying pan and used it to prod gingerly at the unseen ground. Eliciting no movement, and finding the surface relatively firm, he turned the pan over and sat upon it. By bringing the wood close to his face, he could make out the movements of his hands sufficiently as to avoid cutting himself, and with a good deal of labour managed to strip the sapling and trim it to a handy 6-foot length. He then set about whittling the end to a sharpened point. The Great Dismal was dangerous, but it teemed with game. That was the lure that drew hunters into its mysterious depths. William wasn't about to try to kill a bear or even a deer with a homemade spear. He was, however, reasonably adept at gigging frogs, or had been. A groom on his grandfather's estate had taught him long ago. He'd done it often with his father in Virginia, and while it wasn't a skill he'd found occasion to practice in the last few years in London, he felt sure that he hadn't forgotten. He could hear the frogs all round him, cheerfully unimpressed by the fog.
"Brekkekekek, coax, coax," he murmured. "Brekkekekek, coax."
The frogs seemed likewise unimpressed with quotations from Aristophanes.
"Right you, just wait," he said to them, testing his point with a thumb.
Adequate. A gigging spear, ideally, would be trident-shaped.
Well, why not? He had time.
Biting his tongue with concentration, he set about to carve two additional sharpened twigs and notch them to join the main spear. He briefly considered twisting bits of juniper bark to make a binding, but rejected that notion in favour of unravelling a length of thread from the fringe of his shirt. The swamp was sodden in the wake of the storm. He'd lost his tinderbox, but he doubted that even one of Jehovah's thunderbolts, such as he'd witnessed the night before, would ignite a fire here. On the other hand, by the time the sun came out and he eventually succeeded in catching a frog, he'd probably be desperate enough to eat it raw. He paradoxically found this thought comforting. He wasn't going to starve then, nor would he die of thirst. Being in this swamp was like living in a sponge. He had nothing so definite as a plan, only the knowledge that the swamp was large, but finite. That being so, once he had the sun to guide him and could be assured of not wandering in circles, he proposed to make his way in a straight line until he reached solid ground or the lake. If he found the lake, well, Dismal Town was built on its edge. He had only to walk round the circumference, and eventually he would find it. So, provided that he took care with the quaking bogs, didn't fall prey to some larger animal, wasn't bitten by a venomous snake, and didn't take a fever from putrid water or the swamp's miasma, everything would be all right. He tested the binding, jabbing the spear gently into the mud, and found it secure. Nothing to do but wait, then, for the fog to lift. The fog showed no disposition to lift. If anything, it was thicker. He could barely make out his fingers, held a few inches from his eyes. Sighing, he gathered his damp coat round him, settled the gig by his side, and wriggled his spine into a precarious rest against the remaining alders. He put his arms round his knees to hoard what little heat his body still held, and closed his eyes to block the whiteness. The frogs were still at it. Now, without distraction, though, he began to hear the other noises of the swamp. Most of the birds were silent, waiting out the fog as he was, but now and then the deep, startling boom of a bittern echoed through the fog. There were scurrying noises and splashings now and then. Muskrat, he wondered. A loud clunk betokened a turtle dropping off a log into water. He preferred those sounds because he knew what they were. More unnerving were the faint rustlings, which might be the rubbing of branches, though the air was too still, surely, for wind, or the movement of something hunting. The shrill cry of something small cut off abruptly, and the creakings and groanings of the swamp itself. He'd heard the rocks talking to themselves on the fells at Hellwater, the Lake District, his maternal grandparents' home, in the fog. He hadn't told anyone that. He moved a little and felt something just below his jaw, clapping a hand to the spot. He discovered a leech that had attached itself to his neck. Revolted, he ripped it loose and flung it as hard as he could into the fog. Patting himself all over with trembling hands, he settled back into his crouch, trying to repel the memories that came flooding in with the swirling mist. He'd heard his mother, his real mother, whisper to him, too. That was why he'd gone into the fog. They'd been picnicking on the fells, his grandparents and Mama Isabel, and some friends with a few servants. When the fog came down, sudden as it sometimes did, there was a general scurry to pack up the luncheon things, and he had been left by himself, watching the inexorable white wall roll silently toward him. And he'd swear he'd heard a woman's whisper, too low to make out words, but holding somehow a sense of longing, and he had known she spoke to him. And he'd walked into the fog. For a few moments he was fascinated by the movement of the water vapor near the ground, the way it flickered and shimmered and seemed alive. But then the fog grew thicker, and in moments he'd known he was lost. He'd called out, first to the woman he thought must be his mother. The dead come down in fog. That was nearly all he knew about his mother, that she was dead. She'd been no older than he was now when she died. He'd seen three paintings of her. They said he had her hair and her hand with a horse. She'd answered him. He'd swear she'd answered him, but in a voice with no words. He'd felt the caress of cool fingers on his face, and he'd wandered on, entranced. Then he fell, badly, tumbling over rocks into a small hollow, bruising himself and knocking out all his wind. The fog had billowed over him, marching past, urgent in its hurry to engulf things, as he lay stunned and breathless in the bottom of his small declivity. Then he began to hear the rocks murmur all around him, and he'd crawled, then run as fast as he could, screaming, fell again, got up, and went on running. Fell down, finally unable to go further, and huddled terrified and blind on the rough grass, surrounded by vast emptiness. Then he heard them calling out for him, voices he knew, and he tried to cry out in reply, but his throat was raw from screaming, and he made no more than desperate, rasping noises, running toward where he thought the voices were. But sound moves in a fog, and nothing is as it seems, not sound, nor time, nor place. Again and again and again he ran toward the voices, but fell over something, tripped and rolled down a slope, stumbled into rocky outcrops, found himself clinging to the edge of a scarp, the voices now behind him fading into the fog, leaving him. Mac had found him. A big hand had suddenly reached down and grabbed him, and the next minute he was lifted up, bruised and scraped and bleeding, but clutched tight against the Scottish groom's rough shirt, strong arms holding him as though they'd never let him go. He swallowed. When he had the nightmare, sometimes he woke with Mac holding him. Sometimes he didn't, and woke in a cold sweat, unable to go back to sleep for fear of the waiting fog and the voices. He froze now, hearing footsteps, breathed cautiously, and smelled the unmistakable ripe smell of pig shit. He didn't move. Wild pigs were dangerous if you startled them. Snuffling noises, more footsteps, the rustle and shower of water drops as heavy bodies brushed the leaves of holly and yorpen bushes. Several of them moving slowly, but moving nonetheless. He sat up sharp, turning his head to and fro, trying to locate the sound exactly. Nothing could move with purpose in this fog, unless they were following a path. The swamp was crisscrossed with game paths made by deer and used by everything from possums to black bears. These paths wound aimlessly, only two things certain about them. One, that they did lead to drinkable water, and two, that they did not lead into a quaking bog, which, under the circumstances, was enough for William. They'd said one other thing about his mother. Reckless, his grandmother had said sadly, shaking her head. She was always so reckless, so impulsive. And her eyes had rested then on him, apprehensive.
"And you're just like her," said those anxious eyes. "God help us all."
"Maybe I am," he said out loud, and gripping his frog spear, stood up, defiant. "But I'm not dead. Not yet." He knew that much. And that to stand still when lost was a good idea only if someone was looking for you.
Chapter 37 Purgatory. At midday on the third day, he found the lake. He'd come to it through a cathedral of towering bald cypress, their great buttressed trunks rising like pillars from the flooded ground. Half-starved, light-headed from a rising fever, he walked slowly through calf-deep water. The air was still. So was the water. The only movement was the slow drag of his feet and the buzzing insects that plagued him. His eyes were swollen from the bites of mosquitoes, and the louse had company in the form of chiggers and sand fleas. The darning needles that darted to and fro didn't bite like the hundreds of swarming tiny flies, but had their own form of torment. They made him glance at them, sunlight glinting gold and blue and red from their gauzy wings and shining bodies, dizzying in the light. The smooth surface of the water reflected the trees standing in it so perfectly that he couldn't be sure quite where he himself was, balanced precariously between two looking-glass worlds. He kept losing his sense of up and down, the dizzying sights through the branches of the towering cypress above, the same as that below. The trees loomed more than 80 feet over him, and the sight of drifting clouds, seeming to sail straight through the gently stirring branches below, gave him the constant queer sense that he was about to fall. Up or down, he couldn't tell. He'd pulled the cypress splinter from his arm and done his best to bleed the wound, but there were smaller slivers of wood left behind, trapped under the skin, and his arm was hot and throbbing. So was his head. The chill and fog had disappeared as though they had never existed, and he walked slowly through a world of heat and stillness that shimmered round the edges. The backs of his eyes burned. If he kept his eyes fixed on the purling of water away from his boots, the V-shaped waves broke the disturbing reflection and kept him upright. But watching the dragonflies, that made him sway and lose his bearings, as they seemed not fixed in either air or water, but part of both. A strange depression appeared in the water a few inches from his right calf. He blinked, then saw the shadow, sensed the weight of the heavy body undulating through the water. An evil, pointed, triangular head. He gulped air and stopped dead. The moccasin, by great good fortune, did not. He watched it swim away and wondered whether it might be fit to eat. No matter. He'd broken his frog spear, though he'd caught 3 frogs before the fragile binding gave way. Small ones. They hadn't tasted badly, despite the rubbery feel of the raw flesh. His stomach clenched, gnawing, and he fought the insane impulse to dive after the snake, seize it, and rip the flesh from its bones with his teeth. Maybe he could catch a fish. He stood still for several minutes to be sure the snake had left, then swallowed and took another step, and walked on, eyes fixed on the small waves his moving feet made, breaking the looking-glass water into fragments around him. A short time later, though, the surface began to move, hundreds of tiny wavelets lapping against the grey-brown wood of the cypress trees, shimmering so that the dizzy swirl of trees and clouds disappeared. He lifted his head and saw the lake before him. It was vast, much bigger than he had thought it would be. Giant bald cypresses stood in the water, the stumps and carcasses of earlier progenitors bleaching in the sun among them. The far shore was dark, thick with tupelo, alder and hobblebush, and the water itself seemed to stretch for miles before him, brown as tea, with the infusions of the trees that grew in it. Licking his lips, he bent and scooped up a handful of the brown water and drank, then drank again. It was fresh, a little bitter. He wiped a wet hand across his face. The cool wetness made him shiver with a sudden chill.
Right then, he said, feeling breathless.
He pushed ahead, the ground sloping away gradually beneath him until he stood in the open water, the dense growth of the swamp behind him. Chills still swept him, but he ignored them. Lake Drummond had been named for an early governor of North Carolina. A hunting party, including Governor William Drummond, had gone into the swamp. A week later, Drummond, the sole survivor, had staggered out, half dead from hunger and fever, but with news of a huge, unsuspected lake in the midst of the Great Dismal. William drew a long, shuddering breath. Well, nothing had eaten him yet, and he'd reached the lake. Which way was Dismal Town? He scanned the shore slowly, looking for any trace of chimney smoke, any break in the dense growth that might betoken a settlement. Nothing. With a sigh, he reached into his pocket and found a sixpence. He flipped it into the air and nearly missed catching it, fumbling wildly as it bounced off his slow fingers. Got it! Got it! Tails. Left, then. He turned resolutely and set off. His leg knocked against something in the water, and he glanced down just in time to see the white flash of the moccasin's mouth as it rose up in the water and struck at his leg. Reflex alone jerked his foot up, and the snake's fangs stuck briefly in the leather of his boot top. He yelled and shook his leg violently, dislodging the reptile, which flew off and landed with a splash. Nothing daunted, the thing turned round upon itself almost instantly and arrowed toward him through the water. William ripped the frying pan from his belt and swung it with all his strength, scooping the snake from the water and lofting it into the air. He didn't wait to see where it landed, but turned and ran, splashing wildly toward the shore. He rushed up into the growth of gum and juniper and paused, gasping for breath, relieved. The relief was short-lived. He did turn then to look, and saw the snake, its brown skin gleaming like copper, slither its way up onto the bank in his wake, and come undulating determinedly after him across the matted ground. He let out a yelp and fled. He ran blindly, feet squelching at every step, ricocheting off trees and through slapping branches, his legs seized by hobblebush and holly, through which he fought his way in a shower of leaves and torn-off twigs. He didn't look back, but wasn't really looking forward either, and thus ran without warning slap into a man standing in his path. The man let out a cry and went over backward, William atop him. He pushed himself up, and found himself looking down into the face of an astonished Indian. Before he could apologize, someone else grabbed him by the arm and pulled him roughly upright. It was another Indian who said something to him, angry and interrogative. He groped for any stray bit of trade talk, found nothing, and, pointing in the direction of the lake, gasped, "Snake!" The Indians evidently understood the word, though, for their faces changed at once to wariness, and they looked where he was pointing. In support of his story, the annoyed moccasin shot into sight, wriggling through the roots of a sweet gum. The Indians both let out exclamations, and one of them seized a club from a sling at his back and struck at the snake. He missed, and the snake writhed up at once into a tight coil and struck at him. The snake missed too, but not by much, and the Indian jerked back, dropping his club. The other Indian said something in disgust. Taking his own club in hand, he began warily to circle the moccasin. The snake, further enraged by this persecution, spun upon its own contortious coils with a loud hiss and launched itself, spear-like, at the second Indian's foot. He let out a cry and leapt back, though he did keep hold of his club. William, meanwhile, delighted not to be the focus of the snake's annoyance, had backed out of the way. Seeing the snake momentarily off balance, though, if snakes could be said to have any in the first place, he gripped his frying pan, swung it high, and brought it down edge-on with all his force. Brought it down again and again and again, his strength driven by panic. At last he stopped, breathing like a blacksmith's bellows, sweat pouring down his face and body. Swallowing, he lifted the frying pan gingerly
expecting to find the snake a bloody mince on the riven ground. Nothing. He could smell the reptile, a low stench like that of rotten cucumbers, but could see nothing. He squinted, trying to make sense of the mass of cut-up mud and leaves, then looked up at the Indians. One of them shrugged. The other pointed off toward the lake and said something. Evidently the snake had prudently decided that it was outnumbered and returned to its own pursuits. William stood up awkwardly, frying pan in hand. The men all exchanged nervous smiles. He was comfortable with Indians, generally. Many of them crossed his land, and his father always made them welcome, smoking with them on the veranda, taking supper with them. He couldn't tell which people these two claimed. The faces had the look of someone of the Algonquian tribes, high-cheeked and bold, but surely this was far south of their usual hunting grounds. The Indians were examining him in turn and exchanged a glance that set something tingling at the base of his spine. One of them said something to the other, watching him sidelong to see whether he understood. The other smiled broadly at him, showing brown-stained teeth.
"Tobacco?" the Indian asked, extending a hand palm upward.
William nodded, trying to slow his breathing, and reached slowly into his coat, right-handed, so as not to have to set down the frying pan in his left. Likely these two knew the way out of the swamp. He should establish friendly relations, and then... He was trying to think logically, but his lower faculties were interfering. His lower faculties thought he should get the devil away from here, and now. Coming out with a waxed parcel of tobacco, he threw it as hard as he could at the foremost Indian who had started toward him, and ran. A startled exclamation behind him, and then the sound of grunts and thumping feet. His lower faculties, thoroughly justified in their apprehensions, spurred him on, but he knew he couldn't keep it up for long. Being chased by the snake had consumed most of what strength he had, and being obliged to run with an iron frying pan in one hand wasn't helping. His best chance lay in outdistancing them sufficiently as to find a hiding place. With this thought in mind, he drove himself to greater exertions, dashing over open ground beneath a growth of gum trees, then swerving into a thicket of juniper, popping out again almost immediately onto a game trail. He hesitated for an instant. Hide in the thicket? But the urge to run was overwhelming, and he pounded down the narrow trail, vines and branches snatching at his clothes. He heard the pigs in time, thank God. Startled snorts and grunts, and a great rustling of brush and sucking sounds as a number of heavy bodies scrambled to their feet. He smelled warm mud and the reek of pig flesh. There must be a wallow round the curve of the path. Shit, he said under his breath, and leapt into the brush off the path. Jupiter, now what? Climb a tree? He was breathing hard, sweat running in his eyes. All the trees nearby were juniper. Some very large, but dense and twisted, impossible to climb. He dodged round one and crouched behind it, trying to still his breathing. His heart was hammering in his ears. He'd never hear pursuit. Something touched his hand and he swung the frying pan by reflex, leaping to his feet. The dog let out a surprised yelp as the pan glanced off its shoulder, then bared its teeth and growled at him. "What the devil are you doing here?" William hissed at it. Bloody hell, the thing was the size of a small horse. The dog's hackles rose, making it look exactly like a wolf. Jesus, it couldn't be a wolf, surely. And it began to bark. Shut up, for God's sake! But it was too late. He could hear Indian voices, excited and quite near. Stay, he whispered, putting out a palm toward the dog as he edged backward. Stay. Good dog. The dog did not stay, but followed him, continuing to growl and bark. The sound of this further disturbed the pigs. There was a thunder of hooves along the path and a surprised whoop from one of the Indians. William caught a flicker of movement from the corner of his eye and whirled, weapon at the ready. A very tall Indian blinked at him. Hell,
more of them.
Leave off, dog, said the Indian mildly in a distinct Scots accent.
William blinked in turn. The dog did cease barking, though it continued to circle him unnervingly close and growling all the time. Who? William began, but was interrupted by the two original Indians, who at this point appeared suddenly out of the undergrowth. They came to an abrupt halt at the sight of the newcomer, and cast a wary eye at the dog, who turned its attention on them, wrinkling back its muzzle and displaying an impressive array of gleaming teeth. One of the original Indians said something sharp to the newcomer. Thank God they weren't together. The tall Indian replied in a distinctly unfriendly tone. William had no idea what he'd said, but it didn't sit well with the other two. Their faces darkened, and one put a hand impulsively to his club. The dog made a sort of gurgling noise in its throat, and the hand fell at once. The original Indian seemed disposed to argue, but the tall Indian cut them off, saying something peremptory, and flipped a hand in an unmistakable be-off-with-you gesture. The other two exchanged glances, and William, straightening up, moved to stand by the side of the tall Indian and glowered at them. One of them gave him back the evil look, but his friend looked thoughtfully from the tall Indian to the dog and shook his head, the movement almost imperceptible. Without a further word, the two turned and left. William's legs were shaking, waves of fever heat passing over him. Despite a disinclination to get any closer to the dog's level than necessary, he sat down on the ground. His fingers had gone stiff, he'd clutched the handle of the frying pan so hard. With some difficulty, he unbent them and set the thing down beside him.
Thank you, he said,
and wiped a sleeve across his sweating jaw.
You speak English? I've met Englishmen who'd say no. But I think you'll maybe understand me at least.